May it please the court, my name is Alex Higgins, and along with Matt Dean, I represent Don Cornwell, who's back in the courtroom at this time. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
Very well.
The trial court in this case erred in granting summary judgment for Microsoft because it required the plaintiff to produce direct evidence that decision makers had specific knowledge of the nature of her protected activities. This should be reversed for at least two reasons. One, plaintiff has presented sufficient circumstantial evidence of the decision maker's knowledge of the protected activities so that a causal link between the protected activities and the adverse employment action has been established, or may be established as an issue of fact for trial. Secondly, the general corporate knowledge principle from federal case law advances the important public policies of the WLAD and should be applied. I first want to address...
So is there some specific evidence you want to cite us to in the record that shows that the actors in this case had
yes.
specific knowledge of her, that she had engaged in some sort of protected conduct?
I have a one-page handout that I'm going to pass up in 1 second. Allow me to set the stage with the relevant legal standard that comes from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Hernandez versus Space Lab, cited on page 6 of our reply brief. There, the appellate court reversed the summary judgment because the plaintiff provided sufficient evidence from which a reasonable jury could infer that the supervisor knew or suspected that the plaintiff had engaged in protected activity, therefore establishing a causal connection. The court explained, in quotes, "What did he know and when did he know it?" questions are often difficult to answer and for that reason are often inappropriate for resolution on summary judgment. It is frequently impossible for a plaintiff in Hernandez, the plaintiff there, position to discover direct evidence contradicting someone's contention that he did not know something. And Hernandez has no such evidence. But Hernandez has introduced substantial circumstantial evidence, which, if credited by the jury...
Your argument is you've presented substantial circumstantial evidence to
Correct.
Support that Blake and McKinley.
Yes.
No.
And
okay.
I'm going to address that right now.
And you agree that the decision makers here were Blake and McKinley?
Blake and McKinley were the decision makers, and correct. So... here are the key facts that establish that Blake and or McKinley knew or suspected that plaintiff had engaged in protected activity. First of all, when Ms. Cornwell tells her manager of a lawsuit, she, number two, presses for more details and learns it was against a male manager and it was involving performance review scores.
Couldn't that just mean that she had a prior complaint about her review scores?
That is certainly what it could mean, although a lawsuit implies something more than just a complaint about review scores. And so I think all I'm trying to establish here is that it was not a trip and fall in the parking lot, right? It had something to do with employment law, her performance review scores. So again, if the standard is new or suspected and it's circumstantial evidence from which reasonable inferences could be drawn, then I think summary judgment's improvident. You're correct in saying that certainly Microsoft can argue to the jury, hey, that's not the inference that should be drawn. The inference should be drawn that it might have been something else. So then Blake's very interested in this and encourages HR to do detective work about what this case was about. So she's not sufficient, not satisfied just with what she knows. Then Dyer writes to Blake's manager. And this is important. I have a meeting with legal today about Cornwell. I will let you know what I find out. At the very least, we will have some legal eyes on the review, the performance review. What happens next is startling. Nothing. There's no further communication between June, when this email occurs, and the layoff in September. There's no written communication saying, I didn't find out anything, or gee, thanks for letting me know. A reasonable inference from that is that legal told her exactly what the suit was about and said, stop putting things in email about it. And so they had a discussion about it. Now, we can't ask the lawyers what they say, and we can't even ask Jan Dyer what was said because of attorney-client privilege has been asserted in this case. So we're left with a reasonable inference about what happened after that.
But how does that relate to what Blake knew?
Blake's manager, I think there's a reasonable inference that HR did exactly what they promised to do. They called Blake's manager and told her this was about gender discrimination and retaliation a few years ago against this mail manager who you know, named Todd Parsons. That's the reasonable inference to be drawn from this. I will let you know what I find out. I think we should take that person's word, and especially when there's not further emails going back and forth saying, I didn't find out anything, or, hey, they said it was not appropriate for me to tell you anything. It's completely silent at that point. So what inference can be drawn from the lack of email correspondence? I think if I were Blake's manager, Nicole McKinley, and I got this email, I'd follow up with an email saying, okay, well, I never heard from you. What's going on? But what'd you find out? Oh, it's not appropriate to tell me? Fine. But that's not what happened. There was nothing more in the record. The other thing that I think is important is Blake's credibility in this case, number five, has been contested by another Microsoft manager about how she came into that stack ranking meeting. So now we have an issue where a Microsoft manager is saying, Blake's not telling the truth about this whole thing. So I don't think this case should end simply because Marianne Blake says, I didn't know. We're entitled to cross-examine her on these issues and present to the jury our reasonable inferences about what she probably knew when she went into the stack ranking. At the very least, if the standard is what she suspected was going on, boy, that seems to be a much easier standard than actual knowledge. So what she suspected, let me go on to the general corporate knowledge rule for a second. I just have about a minute left. That supports our view that constructive knowledge of protected activities could be enough. And the reason why is because it's so hard to prove what's going on behind closed doors in a corporation where HR and legal and managers are all carefully orchestrating. And that's in the words of HR.
So under that rule, though, so if one person knows of a complaint from five, let's assume it's a protected complaint,
yes,
from 5 years ago, you're saying that that's enough to impute the knowledge to a manager 5 years down the road?
That's enough for purposes of summary judgment. And then at trial, Microsoft might come in and blow that out of the water by showing that was contained. But it should be Microsoft's burden, not the plaintiff's burden, to go in and pick apart through internal emails to show that the case. It should be Microsoft. Microsoft, it's imputed to Microsoft unless they at trial prove that it wasn't. I'll come back to that if I have time in my rebuttal.
All right, you have 3 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Greg Hendershot, here for defendant. This is Laura Turchansky with me. May it please the court. We will focus our time on the causation argument that Judge Chun relied on to grant summary judgment. Judge Chun correctly ruled that to state a prima facie case, plaintiff needs to prove that the decision makers knew that specifically that plaintiff made a discrimination claim and that mere speculation is not enough to survive summary judgment. This court recently made a similar ruling in the Michkowski case. In Michkowski, the plaintiff was fired 4 months after making a safety complaint to one of his supervisors. The supervisor who received the complaint recused himself from the decision to terminate in that case, but the plaintiff speculated that the recused supervisor told the others about the safety complaint. This court held that mere speculation is not enough to survive summary judgment. The facts of the case before you today are more speculative
Having written Michkowski, why is it so hard to find helpful case law that addresses when do you impute in knowledge between employees and supervisors or decision makers and others in the chain of command?
I think there's my response is that there is a lot of case law, and I think I think some of our best cases are the cases the plaintiff cites, like Hernandez, where the day the person made the complaint, his supervisor's buddy came up to him and said, "You're in trouble now," and things like that, as compared to, say, Michkowski or many of these other cases where there's here, I think what makes this so speculative is they can't point to a single person in the record who has knowledge of what happened to even speculate that that person told any of the decision makers. So I think my view is that the case law is reasonably clear that if you have circumstantial evidence, and it's important here to distinguish the prima facie case from the pretext argument that comes after they've established it, but if you have circumstantial evidence that someone, that the decision makers knew specifically, and that's very important, out of a generalized legal complaint, then you can maybe get to the jury. But speculation, hunches, unsupported conspiracy theories, I think, is where that's not enough to get to the jury. And
what about the argument that
that Blake did know it was against a male manager and it involved performance review scores. I think the evidence is that it's 7 years old, and the evidence is Blake didn't know because she asked. And on that point, I want to note, I think it's not fair to draw any inference from her asking, because as I would think, if a manager says, "Hey, I'd like you to fly to Boston," and the employee says, "I can't fly to Boston because of a legal issue I had there," it's completely natural for the supervisor, I think she did what anyone would do, and says, "What's going on with this?" And the evidence is all she did was find out, and she found, what happened is she surfaced it with Cornwell, and Cornwell said it's confidential. And there's nothing more in the record ever about it, and that's what.
But we knew it involved. We knew it involved Mr. Parsons, the previous supervisor.
She said it was in his group, and I think it really kind of more. It didn't really involve him, but yeah, all she said was that it was in his group, and she couldn't be in his group.
Okay. How about the silence? I will let you know what I found out, and then. The gap, no silence.
I think the answer there is there's no evidence. It would be mere speculation to say that she said anything. The plaintiffs deposed Nicole McKinley and Blake. There's evidence in the record that they never knew. There's no indication that they ever knew. So I think could have told is not the same as did tell, I think, is the language from Clover v. Total Health. It's just speculating that someone told. And I think it's also... I don't know anybody who was involved that long ago, but it's important to note that this is a strict confidentiality on this agreement.
Was there any attempted discovery to uncover whether the legal department had any records on this prior complaint?
Pardon?
Was there any discovery by the plaintiffs seeking to find out if the legal department at Microsoft had any records regarding this prior dispute?
Not to my recollection. We do have the letter that went from one outside counsel to another. That is in the record from 2005. And on that point, I don't want to jump around too much. In there, that lawyer says that the plaintiff was complaining about Lisa Chang favoring her boyfriend, Lisa Chang's boyfriend, but also another female named Tracy Yang. That she was exhibiting personal favoritism, and I don't want to get sidetracked on that issue, but it goes again to the issue that underneath all this is no protected activity. But not to my knowledge that they go back and looked at the legal documents from 2005 other than what's in the record. So here I think it's also important to note that the protected activity, which we think, the alleged protected activity predated the alleged adverse action by 7 years. And as you know, the claim before you requires intent. Specific intent and knowledge of an unspecified prior legal action is not enough. And I think the case law is very strong on that, and there are several cases in the record. First, she needs to prove knowledge by the decision makers, and once she gets over that, which she hasn't, and that's what Judge Chun ruled, then she can get into the issue of pretext. Regarding this issue of I want to touch on the corporate knowledge element. Even if the courts were to adopt the corporate knowledge element, it would not change the result because plaintiff still needs to prove causation. There's no case in the record that substitutes generalized corporate knowledge for causation. And as I think the court correctly understands, to impute knowledge of a 7-year-old complaint in 100,000 to every person in a 100,000 company would not make any sense, and it would also gut the intent requirement. And I don't think Judge Chun said required direct evidence. He said you need enough circumstantial evidence that's not speculation. And that's really what the law is distilled down to is speculation, hunches, or unsupported conspiracy theories are not enough. Could have told is not the same as did tell. And we think the key cases are Clover, Michkowski, and Mulhall. The Mulhall v. Ashcroft case has probably the most comprehensive discussion of the issues before the court. And I'd like to focus on some of the facts as why this case is, I think, easily distinguished from the cases plaintiff relies on. First of all, we have 60,000 employees alone in Redmond. This is 7 years old. There's not even a single individual identified in the record beyond speculation that knew the substance of the 2005 complaint. So she can't even speculate somebody told somebody. As I said, there's a confidentiality in place. Very importantly here, as distinguished from Taylor and Hernandez and Deluxe, the complaint was not about the decision makers. She said it was in Todd Parsons' group. the decision makers didn't even know who it was against. But in these other cases, it's a complaint against the decision maker's friend knows about it, or in one case, the person testifies publicly against the decision maker, and then discipline soon follows afterwards. Here, the plaintiff went through a formal evaluation process on the same timelines as everyone else did. She went through the calibration process. There's no out-of-the-blue discipline. She was never disciplined. It was a group layoff. Human Resources was involved in the communications of how the layoff procedures would go. And there's never been any shifting explanation for the review score. And I emphasize plaintiff hasn't even gotten to where we should be debating the review score because she hasn't shown the knowledge by the decision makers. So go ahead.
We were cited supplemental authority of the Diederich case. It's a non-reported Ninth Circuit. Do you have any comments on that?
I think the Diederich is a very different case. If in our case there was evidence that Mary Ann Blake came into a meeting and said, I talked to Lisa Chang and I know all about what happened, we would have a very different case. And so I think it's and that was the decision maker in that case that said that. So I think that it's much more reasonable to draw an inference from that the decision maker had specific knowledge, because it sounds to me when I read the case like he told the plaintiff he did.
But Blake knows this involves Parsons, and knows it involves perhaps litigation and perhaps about the performance review scores. Why isn't that similar? She knows this.
I think it's what we're into is the land is speculation, and I think the record shows she didn't know what it was. She said, what is this? She had this, I just asked her to mentor with a friend. She says she can't. She had a prior legal issue. I don't know what it is. And there's no, and then Cornwell says it's confidential and resolved, and nothing else ever happens. And it goes back to it's pure speculation, and I think it's very far-reaching speculation considering it's 7 years old. In the legal department, under strict confidentiality, it's unsupported speculation to think that somebody told somebody who told somebody who told the decision makers.
Here, she continued to push the issue, though. She continued to research and push HR for answers.
There's two emails and one conversation, so I think that's, in my view, is that's stretching the inference from that. She asked about it once. And said, what did you find out? And then raised it with the plaintiff, and the plaintiff said it's confidential, and then nothing ever happened with regard to it again. So we ask that summary judgment be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I have a couple of quick fact corrections from what I just heard. He just said there were only two emails. That's not true. There's a declaration from Ms. Cornwell that says each week she was asked, continued to be asked by her boss, Mary Ann Blake, why I would not mentor with her friend. The next sentence, this is CP 216, Declaration of Dawn Cornwell. This also rebuts the statement I heard earlier in the argument that all Mary Ann Blake knew was that it somehow vaguely involved Todd Parsons' group. That's not true either. So in the same declaration, Dawn Cornwell finally explained to her, Mary Ann Blake, that I did not feel comfortable because her friend reported to Todd Parsons, against whom I previously had a lawsuit. Very specific, not generally and vague about Todd Parsons' involvement. In terms of the question about why are there, so few cases sort of helping us distinguish what's speculation from what's a reasonable inference, that's a good question. There are cases out there. You do have to dig quite a bit, and I actually agree with counsel that the Mulhall case does contain the most comprehensive discussion of it. And in the Mulhall case, there's a very interesting discussion of a case from the Sixth Circuit called Polk versus Yellow Freight Systems, 876 F. 2nd, 527. There, where the court held that the plaintiff had presented sufficient evidence to support an inference of knowledge of the protected activity, where the plaintiff visited the Michigan Department of Civil Rights and came back to work and the supervisor said, I know where you've been. Now, that could have been a complete bluff on the part of the supervisor. The supervisor, there's nothing more about the supervisor actually following the person or knowing exactly, but it's supervisor is suspecting something's going on. That's, I know where you've been. Is I mean, I think if counsel were representing Yellow Freight in that case, he'd say that's mere speculation that he knew something. That's just a hunch that that means he knew something. Well, the Sixth Circuit thought it was enough to get to trial on whether the supervisor knew of the plaintiff's protected activity. A reasonable jury could infer from the testimony that the supervisor knew. All right. And they say, as opposed to this case, where it's completely hunch and so forth. I also want to say that the point about nobody at Microsoft knew about the protected activity with this 7-year-old complaint. First of all, the fact that it's 7 years old really means nothing to Marianne Blake because she's just found out about it. So the importance is her reaction in that very finite period of time after she finds out. And she gives her a negative performance review and really starts to bear down on her negatively immediately after finding out. But the point made about nobody at Microsoft knew, or we can't point to somebody who knew, we have a letter from the mediation that went to Microsoft's legal counsel. They hired outside counsel. They attended the mediation. They negotiated a settlement. They wrote a check. I mean, I don't know how much more we have to establish that the corporation knew and the legal department knew. And then we have the evidence that the HR person, prodded on by Marianne Blake to do detective work, finally calls the legal department to find out. And I will let you know what I find out from them. And then nothing more in writing about that after that. Marianne Blake apparently was satisfied by whatever she found out from HR's conversation with legal. And then there's evidence, and it's in our brief, that this whole termination was carefully orchestrated by legal and HR in terms of the timing of the review. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thank you. And that concludes our calendar for this morning. We'll be at recess.